It's November 12th, 2023, and welcome to episode 271 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and the things of 1971, we think. Yes. Someday, you know, what is this, 271? I don't know how long I've been reading this intro. It used to be that different people would read the intros. I don't know how suddenly I got stuck to be doing this all the time, but...
All things that are work eventually become polls. Yeah. Probably.
But, that's the story of RCR, unfortunately.
Yeah. But, yeah. So one of these times I'm going to think in advance about what I'm going to say when I reach the ellipsis in our show notes. But it just says, and, dot, dot, dot.
You'll say, over to you, Quinn.
You've done an impressive job of improvising it the entire time I've been on the show. I've never noticed a problem with the format.
Excellent. All right. Well, wonderful. So I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom on my screen is Quinn, a British Columbian recluse.
Hello. Yes, I'm a recluse, and I live in British Columbia, and I'm happy to be here.
Where, in local news, the time changed recently for many of us, except you, I guess. Or did it change drastically for you? I don't know which direction it went.
Well, so I live in a place that does not change time zone. So, it means that the rest of the world shifts around me, which is always sort of weird.
That's how it's always been, right?
Yeah, it's nice that you don't have to change your clocks, but it's not really that much easier unless you don't care about the rest of the world at all, because you still have to interact with the rest of the world, and so you still have to be aware of the time changes. Right. So I think it's still better, but it's not as good as if everyone just stopped doing it,
which they should. It is so dumb.
Twice a year.
Nobody likes it.
No, nobody likes it. Yeah. Problem is nobody can agree on whether we should go to which time permanently. That's the problem. Yeah. Like, every time there's a referendum, hey, let's get rid of daylight savings, everyone's like, yay, let's go to standard time, boo. Okay, let's go to daylight time, boo. You know, so you can't win.
Obviously what you do is go 30 minutes halfway
through.
Middle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now let's talk about Newfoundland, because that's basically exactly what happened there in, like, 1905. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole story, but I won't talk about that.
Instead, I guess what we could do is... make an attempt at least at the year 1971 in computing history. We have been kind of tracking the episode year, episode numbers with the years. 271 would go with 1971. And so, I mean, there are a couple of things. Most of these things have come up at various points when we have been just discussing other things.
And yet they're still the first. They come up over and over in many years, always as the first.
Well, we have no memory of having talked about them before, so it's also the first for us. One of them was computer space. I don't know what it is. It's like the first.
Do it. I dare you. Define it.
Well, I mean, it's a stand-up arcade game, right? A quarter game based on Space War.
I think the claim is that it's the first electronic video game that was both coin operated and generally available to the public.
Okay.
That may be enough qualifiers to make that sentence roughly true.
Isn't it fair to say, though, that it's this, like, the first video arcade game? Isn't that enough of a qualifier?
I don't know. I think people keep finding, like, individual things that were technically video games before that. I don't know.
Okay, I mean, I suppose, like, there were mechanical games of all sorts. There were, like, pachinko-style machines and all sorts of other stuff before. But I think as soon as you throw the word video in there, I feel like that's enough. Because now you're talking about a CRT and a video display. I think then computer space, I think, easily wins that credit.
And it's so amazing looking.
It's so amazing.
They went all in on this thing. Like, it's crazy.
It's not a great game. I have played it.
No.
It's not awesome.
Not great.
It's you against, one spaceship, but really two spaceships, but they move together. And you have four buttons, one for thrust and fire and two for rotate. It's weird, though, that you rotate with your right hand. Like, it's kind of backwards and the buttons are awkward. And
It's basically the game that they were playing on oscilloscopes in MIT or whatever. What was that game? Computer Space War?
Space War. Exclamation point.
Yeah, Space War! Exclamation point. It's that. it's that game. And yeah, that. I mean, it's also basically asteroids, more without the asteroids, for anyone who is wondering, since they can't see the stream what it looks like. But yeah, you can. It's a great example of how the thing that's first isn't necessarily the thing that succeeds, because you got to like refine the formula a little bit, and you can see why this never really took off, but Pong did, because right. Pong is just so obviously a more approachable, more appealing game to an audience who's never seen a video game before.
Though it is quite possible that the early players of this didn't have that hand confusion by being used to asteroids, you know. But apparently, right. if you are used to asteroids, this is near impossible.
Here's a fun thing this is interesting. I was going to point this out. If you look at the score right now, it says 6-5. Mm-hmm. At first, I thought it said B. It can't count above. It's only single digits, mm-hmm. and so if you go above 9, you get a score of A, then B. It's in hex, which is hilarious.
That's cool.
And only tech nerds would do that. Oh, what was the score? The score was F to D. Way to go!
And it seems like you're actually, from what I understand, you're sort of playing against the machine. So like you each get scores.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's time based. You get like a minute and a half for a quarter, and it's whichever gets the highest score. I recently rewatched, or really kind of watched for the first time the whole way through, the movie Jaws, and there's
a frame of it. Yeah.
I was like, oh look, there's a kid playing the computer space.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And this on the screen in the video. So the video that we could link to here is it's called the year 2022. Let's play computer space, and it's by a channel called Down the Rabbit Hole that I do not know. This just came up, so I cannot. I do not know that it is not run by a monster, but let us hope that it is not run by a monster. but anyway, it was a. It had, I think, a relatively big presence in the movie Soylent Green, which I have not seen. I only know, you know, little bits about the end. But and apparently it makes a very annoying noise. But you could see at least this person playing it in the movie.
I could see it showing up in a lot of movies for the same reason that IMAX did, because like production designers just want something that looks cool, and this looks cool. Like there's no question it does, compared to like another arcade game a little bit later, which would have been a giant plywood box, you know, painted, faded, flat black or whatever. This thing looks great on camera.
It's weird in the movie, it's a white one, which I didn't even know existed.
Yeah, they came in a bunch of colors, which was, again, like they really went all out with the design of this thing. Making a molded fiberglass case in this elaborate of a shape, you know, for the first game ever, that's crazy. Like they really pulled out all the stops. If people want another resource for learning about this game, there's a YouTube channel called John's Arcade, which kind of doesn't publish anymore, but he acquired one of these, and he did a teardown of it, and there's a video about how he got it and so on, because they're of course insanely rare, and to find one that's working is extremely rare. So he has one working, and he shows you the insides of it and so on, so it's really cool. John's Arcade.
Yeah, it has no processor, you know, as I understand it, or RAM or ROM or anything.
It's basically like a mini computer like Pong is. It's just sort of solid state logic. Bunch of TTL doing stuff.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, let's see what else. So another thing that came up when I searched for 1971 was the Kenback One, which is the first.
The first.
Simmer down, nerds.
Right, exactly.
There is a hill, and I must die.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, the Kenback One. It is. Perhaps known as the world's first personal computer, maybe. and I mean, I think this also has the same kind of issues, just with in terms of terminology. I mean, like, what is it the first of? But anyway,
it's vaguer
cool
for
looking.
Things like computers. It's harder to narrow down. For
yeah,
kind of easier to pick arcade things versus computer.
Yeah.
It was a very muddy slide, kind of from non. There were no computers to there's lots of computers. At what point was the first one?
Well, and unlike arcade games, which had a pretty linear evolution from like pinball and pachinko, computers had multiple inputs to their evolutionary path. Like there was input from mini computers, and there was input from video games, and there was input from CPU trainers and all of these things. You could look at something like this and say, well, this is more of a microprocessor trainer than it really was a computer. So you can kind of argue the definitions until everyone is mad.
Yeah. No one escapes
and then
the
you
anger.
Have succeeded.
Yes. And then you've made the internet.
First step toward internet rage.
Yes. First, get everyone mad, and then connect them all together.
Step three.
Profit?
Yeah, I don't have much to say about the Kennebec one. I know that you used to be able to get replicas. I think they were like 75% the size. There's probably some name for that scale. But anyway, it might be kind of cool. I bet it's something that this is totally like a display piece. You would not do anything fun on it.
Yeah, what are you going to do with it?
But anyway, so there it is, 1971, the Kennebec one. Arguably, a little bit more impactful was the Intel 4004. How do you say that? 4004?
Yeah, 4004, I guess. I don't know. 4004. Yeah.
And I think this came up, actually, I think we talked about this a fair amount in some past episode, talking about the 50th anniversary project. So there is at 4004.com, which is pretty cool that somebody got that. There's a lot of information about this processor, but it was initially made for this guy, a calculator. What was it? The BusyCom 141 PF. I immediately went to eBay to search, and of course found nothing. I think I found some ribbons actually for it, but. But it was this was basically like the first machine that had the 4004 in it. It was a joint project with Intel and somebody in Japan. And the numbering actually is 4004, but that's like the fourth chip of the four in this computer. So one is ROM and one is RAM and one is some sort of like shift register or something.
Oh, is that how the name came about? It's just. Like the 4000 series, and this was chip number 4 of the set that you need to build a thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that's cool. It's funny that they ranked the CPU 4th.
Right.
Right.
I guess you need one of these two. Whatever. There are. I mean, jokes aside, there are signs that these companies didn't actually appreciate how big CPUs were going to be. Right. Like, isn't there a story around the 4004 that one of the computer makers wanted to buy it from Intel for a computer and they wouldn't sell it to them or something because they didn't design it for that application and they didn't think it was going to be any good for that, and so they wouldn't sell it to them. And then they ended up talking them into the 8088 or something, or the 8080. We'll get email, but there's a story there around where Intel didn't really understand the magnitude of this chip.
Right. Yeah, I thought I read something about them like... someone buying up a bunch of the calculators for the chips too, but there was one thing that came up. I think it was on what page was this on? I just had it up. Maybe it was here. Someone is making a modern thing where if you actually have a 4004, you can put it in there, and then it'll whatever broadcast over or send this video signal out over HDMI and all the other stuff that a modern thing would do. So if you have the most expensive part, then this is your way to modernize it. But this is the ancestor of everything, right? I mean, like, so.
Yeah, the next chip was the 8080, right? Which then quickly became the 8088 or the 8086, which then became everything.
Yeah. There, I have, of course, never had any interaction with the 4004. I think it was like 4-bit or something like that. It was some 4-bit CPU,
And I think it was, if I recall correctly, it was a serial CPU. So like it didn't have like a 4-bit data bus or whatever. It was all serial, so you had to push the bits in and get them out from the registers one at a time, which was pretty common in early calculator CPUs because they weren't that concerned about speed, so they were more concerned about size and pin count. So they did everything serially, and then pretty quickly realized that parallel is going to be important for computers. So the early computer CPUs were all parallel.
Yeah. The other thing that I saw come up about from 1971. I actually haven't managed to quite process this yet. I wrote down email. So it might be the first use of the at sign. It might be the first sending of an email. Did anyone happen to track this down?
Yeah, computerhope.com claims the first email was sent.
There it is.
1971.
Okay.
Okay,
so the first email was sent by Ray Tomlinson in 1971. He sent the email to himself.
Okay, so you think there has to be at least two people with them. Ray's like, no.
Containing the text.
Dear me.
Something like,
how am I?
Yeah, it's all very suspicious to me.
Would that have been on ARPANET, or what network was this email on?
It says the email message was transmitted over ARPANET.
Yes, on ARPANET.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was him telling himself to forward it to five other people or he'd have bad luck. And he's like, what do I do? Yeah. And then the next day he was inundated with spam.
That's right. The next day he got a letter from a Nigerian prince who needs help getting his money out.
He looked on his computer and said, I am death. Whatever.
Exactly.
So, okay. Well, perhaps that happened. We all know how that ended up. That ended up with our inboxes, our to-do list. But okay, anyway, so that surely was not all that happened in 1971.
It was a shorter year.
Yeah. Right. But we'll return to other things that happened in 1971 next time.
Maybe disco.
So given that we have covered 1971 so thoroughly, we can move on to topics of our items of interest in news, and Carrington has the first one. Oh, interesting.
Oh, I do have the first one. It's a short one. I don't think it's worth screen sharing because it hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen. Oh, it's going to happen. John Romero, you may have heard of him, and John Carmack are going to have a reunion live on Twitch on December 10th. They're going to talk about Doom and the origin of Doom, and they're probably going to find out if Doom can be played inside their brains, which of course it can, because Doom can play on anything. And it's kind of neat. So, Doom was a big deal. Romero and Carmack are a big deal, and it's neat that they're going to have a big live Twitch reunion and discuss Doom and its legacy. So that's coming up on John Romero's Twitch channel on December 10th. So lots of notice, like a little less than a month from now. The show will probably be up by then. You got this. And I don't know, I'm going to watch it. How do you not? I'm going to watch it for the hair care tips is what I'm going to watch it
for. Yeah.
Even I am going to watch it for the hair care tips. That's how amazing John Romero's hair is.
Yeah, I just read, almost read. I maybe made 75% of the way through the, what is it called, the Doom guy? I think it was a gift idea a couple times ago. It's good. It's interesting. I haven't gotten to the contentious part yet, so. Anyway, I'm definitely curious to watch that. John Romero was at Kansas Fest. Were you both there?
I was there when he was there.
I was not there with the time that he was. No.
He is super nice.
Yeah.
He is. Super
he
nice
is
guy.
Just like a total sweetheart in person. Really nice guy. Mm-hmm.
And what is most ridiculous about that for me is that I didn't know who this was. I'm like, everybody's very excited about this person here. But and so that's kind of, it's a little frustrating to, after the fact, figure out who it was. It's like, oh, well, I should have been much more excited about this. But anyway, December 10th. Excellent.
It's a random shout-out. We should mention John's very sporadic podcast that he did or is doing with Craig Johnson called Apple Time Warp. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely sporadic, like one episode every 3 years or something. But what's amazing about it, though, is he gets interviews that nobody else can get. He got Nasser Jebeli, and he got Jordan Mechner, and he got Chuck Chuckles Buch, and like just people that like nobody will that they won't talk to anybody. They can probably get Bill Budge, which nobody has ever gotten, except OpenApple. We got like 20 minutes out of him once, but all the legends from back in the day that nobody knows what happened to them, or that they don't talk about the old days or don't want to, those guys have managed to get interviews with them. So it's a real resource, that podcast.
Yeah, that interview with Nasser was just amazing. But I mean, like the fact that there was one.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, because that guy is a recluse, and yep. And he was this just like anonymous legend. Like, he wrote some of the best games on the platform, like before they were even assemblers. Like, he coded them by hand in hex. Like, it's crazy. And he did stuff with Hi-Rez that nobody thought you could do. Mm-hmm. Like a 2 years before anybody else did it. It's amazing stuff.
I feel like I should remember this, but was he the one who could dictate the code?
Probably. Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Yeah, and there wasn't, I mean, his stuff was so early that, like, there wasn't even good documentation for the memory map or the Hi-Rez page or anything. Like, he just figured it all out by poking around in the hardware. That's the incredible thing. And while he had a day job, like, every time I think I might be smart, I learn about a guy like that. And I'm like, nope, I'm dumb. I'm super dumb. Like, I could never have done that.
Yeah. All right. I feel like there was something that I was going to try to talk about. I'll try to figure that out. But in the meantime... Quinn, you have the next thing.
I do. So this came across my feed, and it's kind of a neat little story. It's a 6502 simulator that this guy found. Now this is, I'll share it on the stream here. This is a YouTube channel that I had not seen before called Tea Leaves. It's a very nice channel, actually. Great narration. The guy does all sorts of different retro topics, mostly focused around programming. And he stumbled across this 6502 simulator that runs on an Apple II, and it's really graphical and really lovely. And it animates, you type in some code in assembly, and then it animates the execution of that code through all the registers. It shows you memory, and it shows you the stack, and there's a little ball that like runs around these little wires to between all the different parts of the CPU and RAM and stuff to really show you visually how 6502 works. And it's this really beautiful, amazing thing. And there's a little bit of a mystery around it because he stumbled into this disk image and didn't know where it came from. And he was, because of the quality of it and the sophistication of it, it looks like a later thing, like a 90s fan-made thing. But it turns out it's actually from 1982, so actually very early, and it's actually from MEC. It's the MEC 6502 simulator. But what was the reason that it was a mystery? Now, he's not an Apple II guy, so he didn't necessarily know about MEC or all the stuff that they did or, you know, what was sort of typical at the time. So that's part of why it was more of a mystery to him. But so part of the mystery, though, was that the disk image... If you Google this thing, like if you stumble across this disk image or you download it, what you're going to likely find is the one that's on archive.org. And the problem is that the one that's on archive.org is corrupted. It's like a bad crack or something. I don't know much about the MEC copy protection, but it's something to do with it has 40 tracks or it has half tracks or something. And the disk image that's on archive.org, there's actually two of them, does not correctly have all of that, so it the simulator won't boot, and that's the disk image that has all of the credits as, and the dates and everything about who wrote it and so on. So he just came across the executable of this thing, and hence the mystery. So but the good news is, thanks to the fine folks at Brutal Deluxe, we do have a proper disk image of it. So I've got links in the show notes to the one on archive.org that is bad, and there's actually two of them on archive.org, both uploaded by someone named Sketch the Cow. Those ones apparently do not work. But the one that is on the Brutal Deluxe archive does work. Brutal Deluxe has what it looks like a possibly complete archive of the MEC disks. And it's not linked from their front page, though. So the link I have in the show notes is a deep link into their archive of all the MEC disks. So I kind of had to type in the URL manually to drill down into their website to get the list of disks. It doesn't seem to be linked from the front page. But it's a really neat thing, so it's worth taken a look at. And it's a nice excuse to shout out this Tea Leaves YouTube channel, which is small, but looks really good. So he should be getting more views than he's getting.
Cool. By the way, Sketch the Cow is Jason Scott.
Oh, okay.
There you go. I mean, largely what that means is that, you know, it's probably just some archive that somebody dumped on him. So without, you know, without checking it, just getting it up.
Yeah, or somebody, maybe it was in one of those giant box of discs that he, like, just ripped on autopilot without really looking at all of them. Yeah, again, like you said, just to get it up. Because the disc does boot, and you can do a catalog, and everything seems like it's there, but when you actually try to run the simulator, it's corrupted. So that's, yeah.
Mech is tricky, too. I mean, they have so much stuff. I mean, at least from what I understand, they generally had visible versions, like on their discs it would say version 1.2 or whatever, so you could at least tell, do we have this version of this program? But
there
are many, many of these.
Yeah, and from talking to 4AM Mech, their copy protection was not trivial either. They had different ones and some pretty sophisticated ones, so they're not necessarily super easy to archive. What does Mech stand for again? Do you remember Minnesota?
Yeah, it's Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium is at least how that started initially.
Okay. So for non-Apple people, they made a ton of educational software for the Apple II. They're the ones that published Oregon Trail, right? That's the one everybody would know, yeah. Mech, if you were an Apple II user, you had at least some Mech stuff for sure, because they did a ton of great stuff. To give credit where it's due, this 6502 simulator we think was written by someone named Dan Patch and possibly Tom Vanderpool, who was apparently part organizer of the very first Kansas Fest. So those names might mean someone to somebody. The fellow in the YouTube channel here, Tea Leaves, he did a bit of a deep dive on those names, and that's what he came up with. So Dan Patch appears to be the author of this simulator, and Tom Vanderpool appears to be the distributor of it, and or he wrote an AppleSoft wrapper around this simulator. But it's a really neat thing because it runs 6502 code. It's like an emulator, but it's running on the actual hardware, which is not something you see very often. So it's pretty cool to see that happening. Obviously, it runs very, very slowly, but it's sort of intentionally slow because the whole point is to teach you how the 6502 works. And you can pause it, and it shows you all the status registers or status flags, and it shows you what state the CPU is in, you know, fetch, execute, and so on. And you can really see how the chip works. It's a pretty cool thing.
It is possible. So the name Dan Patch actually is somewhat familiar to me from the Twin Cities, you know, Minneapolis area. And it's probably the same guy. I mean, this is the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium. There even is now, currently, a Dan Patch Computers listing on Yelp. But
interesting.
So, but I think also, I have a sort of a cross connection here with also a pirate named Dan Patch. You know, you'd see something that'd be like cracked by Dan Patch of the Minneapolis Pirates Guild or whatever it is. And it's possible that he was just, he didn't care just used his name everywhere. Maybe this was some kind of a handle that he used in public for his computer store. But because I think there was like a consulting company and whatever. But I suspect that this is sort of Twin Cities local legendary computer guy from the early 80s.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, yeah, when I heard the name Dan Patch, that's the first thing I thought is it sounded like a cracker handle or a BBS handle. Yeah, like Dan Patch, really? Like Bob Disc? Like what?
Right.
And the name Tom Vanderpool is apparently he was employed by Resource Central, which was like an early Apple II-related business. And he submitted this simulator apparently to the Apple Bits user group. I don't know what city that user group was in, but that's apparently where this copy of this simulator first surfaced. I suspect that it may have been pirated early on at some point and submitted to this user group. I think Tom Vanderpool's distribution of it may in fact be an early crack of it, if I had to guess. And maybe Dan Patch wrote it for Mech, but there's some there's a story here somewhere. It's kind of interesting to unpack.
Well, and it might actually be, you know, if it's possible to contact Dan Patch at Dan Patch Computers in Burnsville, Minnesota. You know, maybe you could just ask him. It would be kind of interesting to do.
Yeah. Yeah. If he's in Minnesota, it's probably the same guy. Like, that's too much of a coincidence. Yeah. It's probably the same guy. Maybe he listens to the show.
If so, we are.
If he does, we think your simulator is really cool, Dan.
Yeah.
We do. We do think that.
Only took us 45 years to find it, but it's really cool.
Yeah. And probably not that many. Well, actually, with something like Mech. I wonder how the payment was arranged. You know, if Mech paid somebody to make the thing and then they took all of the subsequent money, or whether there was percentages or something. I bet it's the former.
Yeah, those early software companies had a lot of different business models, and early software writers got screwed and some got rich, and it seemed to be down to what kind of a phone call you had with the publisher when you signed on to make a thing for them. Sharing on the screen here.
It isn't quite, but it will be here. Okay, now it is.
Oh, there we go. I was just sharing the list of Brutal Deluxe Mech discs, the archive. This link will be in the show notes, but it's at brutaldeluxe.fr/project/mech/discs. So if you go there, then they have what, as I say, appears to be a pretty complete Mech archive. There's so many Mech things, who knows if they're all here, but and like you said, who knows if every version of everyone is here, but they seem to be, based on a random sampling, all good disk images that work. A lot of them are 4AM cracks, who of course he prides himself on making functional cracks as opposed to just ones that exist, you know, compared to the archive.org ones where it's more about getting it up there and who knows if they work. So that's this is a good resource to supplement archive.org. And in a perfect world, I guess someone would go and replace all the archive.org images with these ones since these ones work. But, you know, who's got time for that?
Yeah, there is also the Call Apple, this user group / magazine, has a like subsite, mech.co, which has... some of the manuals and some of these disk images and stuff. I'm not sure if they have everything, but they do have a number of things there. So that's a third place that you can look for Mech stuff.
Good to know.
Was I going to say something? Oh, Resource Central. I think you mentioned Tom Vanderpool was somehow associated with that. And
he was employed by them, I think. Yeah.
So I think, right, the meeting that turned into Kansas Fest was, I think, a Resource Central developers meeting of some sort that was held in Kansas City. And people just started referring to it as Kansas Fest. But
He's apparently credited as the co-founder of the entire show, their very first episode or iteration of Kansas Fest. He was apparently one of the people that was on the board or started it or whatever.
Yeah, and it really was, I think, at that point, you know, a professional developers meeting. You know, it was not hanging out, you know, eating marshmallows or whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it started when the software was current, when the hardware was current. Not it wasn't a retro thing at all. It just became a retro thing because we just kept doing it.
Okay, Carrington, you have the next thing.
I do. What have I got? Oh, I'm even sharing it. Look at me. Woo, go. Okay, so Ion Neo is kind of known for making Steam Deck type things, so handheld games. If you want to play PC games or a lot of retro games or arcade simulators and stuff, and you can do them on their handhelds. Well, they have announced a new thing coming soon, and I want to buy it. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. They're going into the mini PC market, and they've decided to make it a retro mini PC, and it's adorable. So absolutely fashioned off the look of an old Mac is what they picked for their retro mini PC AM01. And it's just so cute. I want this thing so badly. If anything is going to make me buy a mini PC, it's this. I'm going to buy a mini PC. It's not available now. Looks like it's going to be initially released through an Indiegogo campaign, which is going to launch in the next week, it looks like, and will come with a bunch of options. So you'll pick your processor and various things. Who knows what? I don't know. But there's been an announcement video and a bunch of gorgeous product shots on their website. So if you're in the market for a mini PC, and you listen to this show, then probably this is the mini PC you're going against.
Yeah.
And I'm really keen on mini PCs. Like, they've come a long way. And if you want to make a, especially if you're playing older things or you want to make a main machine or a Battistar machine or something, it's a great way to go. And just the industrial design on this is just absolutely sweet and adorable. It looks like there's this cover part that won't be video, but you'll be able to get different things on it. Because some of the product shots show different items in what would be this little mini Max screen. So I think that's going to be something you can either customize or order different versions. It's adorable. My gosh. So it's probably going to cost more than it should, and I'm almost certainly going to buy it because it's so cute.
Is it real? Because all of the product shots appear to be renders, which always makes me suspicious.
There's a video showing people interacting with one, so there's at least a mock-up. And the announcement said, oh, it's coming in, you know, November this year. But it turns out, no, the Indiegogo campaign is going to launch in a week. And then it's probably coming a year from now. So it's like prepay and you'll get what you get. But at least Aya Neo has been around for a while, so they've got a pretty good history of actually making things. It'll probably, I don't know. I'm going to give them money and I hope eventually going to have one of these things. It's so cute. It's so adorable. Yeah.
Very cool.
So if you're just listening, too bad for you. In our audio podcast, I'm going to talk about how a gorgeous thing is, and you have to just imagine it. But we'll have links in the show notes to the Indiegogo campaign and also to a YouTube video that shows the product or what it's going to look like, and to get you all excited the way I'm all excited about it.
Excellent.
Best looking mini computer ever. Which is a low bar. They're mostly ugly little cubes. This one is cute.
I've got a Mac Mini running, like a 2008 or something Mac Mini running my main machine, largely because it's at the time that was the best looking mini size computer you could buy. But getting a Mac to run MAME well with a front end was not easy because it's very much a PC world. It's easier nowadays. MAME is more cross-platform, but in those days, getting a good MAME front end for Macs was extremely difficult. But I suffered through because, as you said, you couldn't buy nice-looking mini PCs, and this thing was going to sit in my house, and I wanted to not have to be sad when I look at it. So this thing would be great for that, for sure.
Depending on its cost, there's a good chance I will be gutting it and turning it into a Mac of some sort anyway.
Okay, so I guess with that, we can move quickly to a word from our sponsor.
Hey, you want to see some dinosaurs?
Yeah, dinosaurs.
Let's get them in here. Loading CD-ROM into Windows.
Where's the dinosaurs, Dad?
I'm not sure. DOS command dot.
Can we see them now?
Not yet. Fig dot sys. Configure jumpers and dip switches.
Dad, what's a dip?
I don't know. Where are you going, kiddo?
To the Crandalls.
What's at the Crandalls?
They have a Mac.
The heads of four leading computer game companies are selecting the best feature of the Atari XE game system. The system with the power to play computer games. Gentlemen, your decision?
Computer animation!
One at a time, please.
Lode Runner has 150 levels. High-tech animation is the story on the XE.
Sound effects are a must for summer games. The XE practically sings.
Flight Simulator needs computer power. Only the XE has it.
But look at the great graphics on Hardball.
So what's a great game system for playing your computer games?
The Atari XE!
They agree.
We're in the middle of the most boring meeting in the history of Western civilization. Joe checked out an hour ago dreaming of fields of clover and a girl named Cindy. Suddenly his boss asks him how many feet of zinc tubing we have in stock. I could let him hang, but instead I send him the answer. Am I basically good, or do I just lack the courage to be evil? Newton communicates.
And we're back. I always wanted to say that.
So the retro competing gift idea this time, we think, wasn't the one from last time, which is dust covers. We talk about dust covers a lot, particularly whenever Carrington is on. But
thank you for saying we talk about it a lot.
No, I think so last time I think there was a Commodore cover, because I remember actually finding the the photo of the one that I have of a VIC-20 with a sort of keyboard cover on it, and we talked a little bit about dust covers, but that is the proposal for the retro competing gift idea this time. So we have a few of them on the Vitno shop. This is a Etsy listing in Ottawa. I wonder if this is related to Vintage is the New Old. I don't know.
Oh, it must be. Yeah, that acronym, eh?
But there are a lot of a number of Discovers. There's Commodore 64C, and of course the thing about these is that you would like them to be sort of the shape of the computer that you're putting under it. TRS-80 Model 3 or 4, Commodore 64. It looks nice. I'm of several minds about this. I mean, I sort of, in a sense, it would be nice not to have to dust the computers, like I would dust the computers. But at the same time, you know, if you have a shelf with a bunch of dust covers on it, then it's not exactly the retro feel that you want.
Yeah, that's true. The machines aren't on display then, yeah. Yeah, you're looking at a bunch of rags.
It is cheaper to buy dust covers and foam blocks roughly the size of retro computers.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So if you want that sweet, sweet cachet of being a retro computer collector at the clubs where people are like, whoa, you look out.
Yeah.
Is how to do it on the cheap. He said knowingly.
Yeah. However, yeah, this is by the way, the it is the Vintage is the New Old person. So
I'm similar to you in that I'm kind of two minds of them, but I'm very tempted by dust covers because for the first time in my adult life, I actually have my retro computers out. They're not in storage, and so they're sitting out, and I sort of feel guilty that they're sitting there getting dusty, and so I kind of like the idea of them being covered, but at the same time, yeah, like you say, then you don't get to look at them, and then they're just blobs of fabric sitting in the corner instead of cool computers, so... yeah, I don't know.
And also, technically, you could be robbed and not know it. And then you sit down one day and you unveil the cover. It's not a Model 3. And then you're pulling off cover after cover. And it's just notes from Carrington saying, ha ha.
Yeah, someone Indiana Jones your retro computer right out of there. It's just a little stack of rocks underneath each one.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose you could...
I weighed them all and they were the same. I didn't know they were missing.
You could have, I suppose, like, clear... covers, but that actually wouldn't look very good either.
Those existed back in the day, and they looked sort of chintzy. They looked like your grandma who had a plastic cover on her couch, right. And it just made it look unpleasant, and nobody wanted to sit on it. It kind of had that feel to it.
And if you did sit on it, everyone knew in the entire floor that you had sat on the couch.
Yeah, crunch, crunch. It is interesting to me, though, that how... back in the day, there were dust covers galore. Like, everybody had one. There was third-party companies that sold dust covers for every single machine. I don't think anybody ever bought them because you were using your computer all the time. So covering it seemed silly because those of us who had them used them at least once a day, often many hours a day.
But
so,
workplaces would have them.
Maybe. But again, like, I don't know. If you have a computer at your desk, you're using it all day.
No, but when you leave... they cover it up and they go for the night.
It doesn't get dusty all night, though. You know.
No, we worked in all the clean offices.
In offices. Yeah.
Some of us worked in factories, baby, and things got dirty.
Yeah, that I could see. But the point of all that, though, was that I think they are much more useful now because now we have these computers that sit around for weeks on end and do get dusty. So I think dust covers make more sense now. But, of course, now we want to look at them. Oh, that's a cool one. What's this one, Paul?
So I had located a... so this is specifically for an Atari, whatever it is, 800XL, something of that sort, which is just it looks like a hard, clear plastic cover around that you put around it. So it has room for the keys underneath. Oh, it actually looks like it just sits on top. Dust cover for Atari. Protect your precious Atari against dust. I don't know if it's old. I don't think it's old.
The name of the company is Retronix, so I'm going to guess not old.
It's too bad they don't make a cover for the Atari 800XL that is printed to look like the much better looking Atari 800, and you put it over that, because that's the one you know you really wish you had.
Yeah, or maybe makes it look like a Commodore. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to fool anyone to think it's an Apple, so you got to make a lateral move if you want to get away from Atari.
Oh, I should go into that's a great business to actually print covers for non-Apple computers that look like Apple computers.
Right. Exactly.
You know you really prefer this.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Passive-aggressive dust covers.
R2 in the comments does say that offices Carrington is correct. Offices did have dust covers.
Yeah, Carrington is correct. Retro
don't need to read past the first three letters there.
Oh, don't encourage him.
Encourage me. I am incorrigible.
I don't know. I worked in offices. We didn't have dust covers on our computers, but...
You worked in clean offices in America.
Hmm. Yeah. It was... Well, no, this was in Canada. This was the 90s, I think, was first. Was
before we kick you out.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah. I mean, to be fair, so the very first office I ever worked in that had a computer in it was my dad's veterinary clinic. And that thing needed
presumably
a dust cover.
Presumably clean. Oh, really? I would have thought, oh, I guess fur everywhere.
The right. Pet hair. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Every few weeks, we'd have to strip that thing down and clean the cat hair out of it.
Okay, do vets have pet computers? Is that the model used or not?
No.
That's
oh,
a
good
missed
one,
opportunity.
Yep. Yeah, that is a missed opportunity. No, this was a DOS PC. Veterinary medicine, much like dentists or eye doctors or whatever, are the world's worst vertical for software. So you have to use this terrible hardware that they require you to use, and you use this terrible software that's 15 years old that has all proprietary binary file formats, and it's all terrible. But they have a captive market. So
is it always 15 years old? Do they update? But they update on a schedule.
It kind of was.
15 years old.
So my dad ran his business on a DOS PC XT clone until, like, I want to say 2003, something like that, because that's how bad the software is. And there was nobody, and it's all proprietary, and there was no way to migrate it to other newer pieces of software. So what he ended up doing, actually, just before my sister took over the business, was he had to hire someone to print out all of the patient files and records and retype them into the new software, because there was no way to migrate the data, because these companies are all terrible. Like, and there's no competition in these niche verticals like veterinary office software. It's all terrible, and they pay way too much for it, and they have to have these terrible support contracts, and that's what happens when you don't have any competition in a space. But all that to say that, yes, I spent a lot of time cleaning cat hair out of my dad's PC XT because the fan would just suck it in, and it's sitting on the floor, and that's where the cat hair sits, is on the floor. And so it would just suck cat hair into the fan, and there'd just be a layer of cat hair covering the motherboard, and it would start to overheat, and that's when you knew it was time to clean the cat hair out of the computer.
It might actually be kind of like a mouse deterrent, though.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah. I tried actually putting a filter on the fan. I put like a block of porous foam on top of the fan. Didn't really work. I blocked too much airflow just to try to keep the cat hair out of it. But so dust cover would have been great there, maybe.
Curtis mentioned that he has a Coco one from Radio Shack that's kind of translucent and never uses it. And I can imagine that. I mean, like, I know what that kind of thing looks like, even if I don't know what this particular one looks like. And it's kind of... You know, it's just not very displayable, and it's going to turn yellow.
What we need is some way to encase the computer in Lucite in a way that still makes it operational.
Oh, it's the last part that makes it hard.
Yeah.
I mean, is it operational anyway? Yeah. I mean, that's one issue, but anyway, so if you're, if you find the idea of a dust cover interesting, there are some options. At least one of them being the list of options on the Vitno shop Etsy store. So,
apparently, so from the chat, we have to add a square to the RCR bingo. In addition to Linux ruined Unix. Fight me, nerds. Apparently, I rant about medical vertical software a lot. Yeah. So we'll add that under the Carrington's girlfriend free square. Like, maybe.
And then how would you end up doing? Great. Or excellent.
Oh yeah.
Feather dust your C64 once a month, says Christopher. Oh yes, I'll just get my feather dust.
I had one of those once. They don't work all that great. They just kind of spread the dust around.
Right. Just get a whole bird. Just shake it.
So when you're finished buying dust covers for your various computers, you can turn your attention to eBay and auctions. And Carrington has a quite accessible auction for us to begin.
It's $10,000. Everybody wants it, but it is both the rarest and ugliest of our books. Yes. It is the JLPGA. That's a couple of that often. So the Japanese Ladies Professional Golf Association in the John Skelly era, they decided to make a commemorative PowerBook 170, which is popular in Japan. I think only available in Japan, maybe. It was the light, very for the time, like maybe 15, 18 pounds, something like that. It is both a color PowerBook and a not color PowerBook.
Yeah.
The screen is grayscale, the computer is blue and white and yellow and like red. It has a white cover. This is actually how this computer came. It's not painted by a user. This is how this computer came. It is quite an obscure little thing. It's an explosion of color. This one has a small repair here. I can see on the latches on the side often get repaired, but it is a very rare computer. Something like 500 of these were made, which is why they go for things like $10,000 on eBay. So if you want a remarkably obscure, remarkably ugly PowerPoint,
yeah,
then there's one for sale on eBay right now.
I thought you were kidding. It is literally made for the Japanese Ladies Professional Golf Association.
This is the JLPGA PowerBook 170. It was specifically for that market. John Sculley was just all about, you know, like, there are no such thing as too many product categories.
Clearly.
This thing has always fascinated me of all the PowerBooks. I love the original PowerBook form factor. Having the idea that the keyboard was forward and the chin is where you rest your palms. It's pre-trackpad, so it's got the trackball. There's a lot of fun things about a PowerBook. They're way heavier than people remember. You pick these things up, and my goodness. But this is a shockingly, ridiculously colored computer. And I love the fact that this is how it came from Apple. Like, these colors, these choices were made by Apple to make a computer look like this. And so, again,
wild.
They made like 500 of them or something. Super collectible. But they do pop up on eBay, but they're usually something like this, $10,000.
So. And it's got the Japanese keyboard too, of course, which is pretty cool. That's not something you see a lot, even just for that feature.
Yep. So, there you go.
Interesting.
Yeah, the my mom had the original PowerBook 100, and I love that thing. That's one of my favorite computers probably that we've had in our family. That thing was just a joy to use. It was so well designed.
Interestingly, very different than the rest of the PowerBooks. The 100 was made by Sony.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Not even manufactured by Apple. It was Sony one. Lots of components are not compatible. It's very different than the ones that came right after it.
I did not know that. It had the external floppy drive, which at the time was pretty innovative. Like, it was a really good idea. Like, oh, actually, you don't need floppies that often. Like, classic Apple now, you know, they just start removing stuff that you don't need that often. But it worked really well because it made the machine way smaller and way lighter, and you really didn't need the floppy drive that often. So you could still plug it in when you needed it. But yeah, great machine.
I'm pretty sure with the 100 as well, you could do a battery swap without... You could shut it down and went to a sleep. You could pull out the battery, put another one in really quickly.
That sounds familiar.
Weird
yeah.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. I think, and they were sort of modular. Like, you could get ones that had two batteries or one battery and one hard drive or two hard drives. Like, they had kind of a, I don't know if it was specifically the 100, but one of the.
Yeah, later PowerBooks did, the 500 series, I think, or whatever. Yeah. But there was, but the 100 is neat because, little Sony thing, 68K. But anyway, today we're talking about the totally beautiful, very stylish JLPGA 170. Ridiculous
this,
looking.
This thing is wild looking at,
It's that whole Memphis design thing that gripped the 80s for a while, and it's like the computer personification. And this is a working one, shown tested and working. For the low, low price of $10,000 US.
I always think that this looks like it's Lego. You know, that it looks like Lego colors
does,
to me.
Yeah.
It does.
Good point. Yeah, it's a good analogy.
So, Paul, whenever I come up with eBay things, the goal, of course, deep down, is to sell it to you. How many of these do you
have?
Zero. Is this your opportunity to get another one? But zero.
I wonder if I have not been very into the PowerBook collecting.
Well, you can start here.
Right.
Think it will make the rest of your collection seem so inexpensive.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, if you were a PowerBook or a 90s Mac completionist...
Then you hate the fact that this thing exists.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, because you're never going to get one, or you're going to have to pay five-figure money for it. And this thing is just always going to be a gap in your collection forever. It used to be the 20th anniversary Macs, but now you can get those. Like, they seem to have come down in price. But now there's things like this, apparently.
Ooh, R2 in the chat says it's Hot Wheels PowerBook. Yep. Yes.
Yes.
Well,
good call.
Very, very accurate.
It's got the Hot Wheels aesthetic for sure.
Anyway, Paul will eventually buy one.
I will. You
know, PowerBook by Mattel.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. I have
What do you got to compete with that?
Well, I have something that is, it's maybe not quite as expensive, but it's among the more expensive things. So this, I have a sort of standing search out for this, and, you know, mostly not just out of curiosity, and mainly it's if somebody ever posts it that doesn't know what one is, that I maybe might be able to grab. But
I don't know what it is.
And it's been so long since I started this standing search that I'm not sure that I'm going to fully remember all the details either. But so Symbolics is a company that made Lisp machines. So they made a computer that was basically, you know, the whole operating system was built on Lisp, but it was specifically engineered to run Lisp well. And at some point, I'm not sure exactly how this fits into the history, but they made a version of this that would essentially use a Macintosh as the I/O. So it has, I think, the memory and the keyboard and the display and all that. But it's a card that goes in your Mac, but it is essentially turning your Mac into a Lisp machine. So that's the Mac Ivory card. And so it goes into a Nubus slot. And I think, you know, it basically becomes the brain, and the rest of the Mac becomes the interface. And it, you know, runs Lisp well. It didn't take off. So at this point, you know, so they're rare. They were super expensive at the time. This one is presently. Oh, look at that exchange rate. This isn't actually as super expensive as I was anticipating. It is this is in Australia, and it is being sold for Australian $4,250, which equates to US about $2,700. So that actually is less than I was anticipating. I'm still not probably going to get it, but it's interesting that it came up, and it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, the US dollar is monstrous right now. It's kicking the Canadian dollar's butt. I don't know what's up with your currency. Stop it. Making everything expensive.
This card is a monster. Like, it's like three layers of circuit boards, and every layer is just packed full of stuff. Holy cow. This card is a beast.
It must get toasty.
Yeah, no kidding. This is the kind of card that, like, three professors in universities had in their Macs on their desks in their office because they are doing stuff with Lisp or whatever. And that's the only people that ever bought this.
I wonder if even with the expense of the card at the time and the expense of Macs at the time, which were quite dear, it was probably still less expensive than buying a dedicated Lisp machine.
Yeah, I think so.
But also why, like, only universities or people like that would buy it, because your total outlay was probably 10 grand by the time you had a Power Mac with this thing in it. And you better have a darn good need for it, and or an institution that isn't going to flinch at a price tag like that.
Right. Hey, the origin of the standing desk.
Right. So on the screen there's a picture of a Symbolics Lisp machine, which is, you know, it's a little mini fridge with a monitor and keyboard on top. So I think this is what the sort of Mac thing was supposed to replace.
Right.
The 3600 series. Ivory processors were marketed in standalone Lisp machines, headless Lisp machines, and on add-in cards for Suns and Apples.
This whole niche has always been strange to me, that Lisp machines, the fact that they existed, like, that people loved this language so much that they leaned all the way into hardware acceleration of that specific programming language. Like, it was deemed that important that it deserved this treatment for two decades. They were dedicated hardware designed to run Lisp. I guess maybe that's a whole... There must be reasons for it that I don't understand, but it just seems strange to me.
I'm pretty sure that I have started a Symbolics session on my computer. Like, I there's some emulator that can run it. But the other thing about Symbolics too, is that it is the first internet domain, symbolics.com. The first .com domain in the world was symbolics.com. So, unrelated probably to that card, but there you go.
But what was it about Lisp that deserved this treatment? Like, why is there a whole industry of Lisp, dedicated Lisp hardware, but there was never that for Fortran or Forth or I don't know, Miranda or any of a zillion other academic languages. Well, I guess because it was AI focused and some people thought it was going to be the future or something. There must be some reason why people leaned so hard into Lisp. I mean, I know it's popular to this day, like Emacs is written in Lisp and so on. And lots of languages like TCL are derived from Lisp. But I don't know, it just doesn't seem to deserve this level of obsession.
People love that food pee joke so much. Yeah. Like, you know what?
There you go.
I'm leading heavy into it. It's got to be something like that.
It kind of feels like you could imagine that just the structure of the language, the architecture of the language really does feel like if you had something that was specifically for a processing list and chopping them off and doing this sort of thing, that you might be able to improve things. I don't know, speed wise, but
yeah, I don't know very much about Lisp, so maybe if I did, it would make more sense. But it just seems a strange thing to lean this hard into. Maybe they needed all this hardware to process the parentheses.
Right.
I don't know. That's the only thing I know about Lisp is there's a lot of parentheses, so I get to make that joke. That's all I got.
Well, and that's if you're debugging, that actually is true in many languages. Debugging is just like, you know, how many more parentheses until it compiles.
Yeah, exactly. Having looked at a lot of student C code, you just keep adding parentheses, ampersands, and asterisks until it compiles.
Yep.
And then often it still works, but they don't know why.
Right. Okay, let's see. What else? What was next? Oh, I thought this was kind of interesting. So I was surprised to see a listing for the Graphics Magician Mac Edition.
I didn't even notice it was a Mac edition.
Yeah, I didn't know this was a Mac version of this.
I had no idea this was a Mac software. Yeah. It's so iconically Apple II.
It did exist for other platforms too. It might have been just Atari, but it may have been Commodore also. Atari's fairly close to the Apple II in a lot of ways, so it wouldn't have been that hard to port. But yeah, so what I think of the Graphics Magician as, so one of the things I think of it as is, it was one of the first couple of pieces of software I ever bought, you know, for the Apple II. You know, so it was, in fact, I think once we did have a...
Wait, you could buy software for the Apple II?
Even
it didn't just come on modems?
I'm pretty sure that, at some point we had an idea, I don't know if it was a topic or whatever, about, like, what you would bring with you on a desert island or something if you could only bring one piece of software. And this was one of the ones I thought, you know, like, I would bring something that I could use to make games to play. You know.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, because you would get bored of any individual game eventually, so you want a game maker through. Okay.
Makes sense.
Because Polarware was also famous for publishing like graphical text adventure type things, like Transylvania or whatever. So,
when they used to be Penguin, right? Like Graphics Magician on Apple II was published under Penguin. And so many early games used Graphics Magician. Like you could always tell because it had that distinctive way that it rendered the screen. It would draw all the lines and then fill everything in slowly and... So many early text adventures and graphic adventure games all used it.
Yeah, because it was recording the instructions rather than the pixels, basically.
Yeah, it was a vector drawing program, which at the time was like a super clever idea to get a lot of graphics into a tiny amount of space.
The other thing, though, that I used more than that was the... It had sort of like animation libraries for shapes, you know, so like if you wanted to make a little game where you had some sort of player running around the screen, you know, it had the machine language routines that you could call to make it go fast, so that, you know, you could write most of your program in BASIC and then still use them, or not, or, you know, you could write it in assembly as well. But so this is very incongruous to my idea of how the Mac works. I mean, like, you know, on the Apple II, you play around in machine language. You drop into the monitor and do stuff and then come back out and, you know, affect pixels directly on the screen. And so it almost didn't make any sense to me that it could be for the Mac.
Yeah, on the Apple II, it was solving a very specific problem, which is how to draw and render a lot of graphics quickly on a platform where that was very, very difficult to do. Whereas on the Mac, you don't have that problem. So what problem is this solving on the Mac? Is it just an art program or just an animation program then?
Well, it's also it's a compression thing too, it says. It says when you make stuff, instead of getting just 18 to 36 pictures, you'll get hundreds on a disk. So
okay.
I think it's also...
So it's still a vector drawing and animation program, but it's just probably less of a technical challenge and more of a production challenge on the Mac that it's solving. Mm-hmm. Like it's a convenient piece of software for doing all of your artwork for your program, but it's not solving a massive technical problem that most programmers had at the time, which it was on the Apple II.
Like, imagine if you're used to developing, say, games or whatever on the Apple II, and then you're moving over to a Macintosh, you'd be like, oh, this is a familiar thing. So it would have that appeal, maybe?
Maybe, although the interface is completely different. So I don't know.
But it's still a magician.
It does seem to have, still has an animator. It says the graphics magician animator, you know, has,
yeah,
has a shape editor and a path editor.
Yeah, I can see it being useful just as a software production tool, but less so as a low-level graphics library that you depended on in the shipping product of your game, yeah, you know?
But anyway, so I did not know that existed for the Mac before this auction came up, so I thought that was interesting.
It's interesting that they did not modernize the logo. Like, the Graphics Magician logo is very kind of dated by this point. Like, it was sort of kitschy and fun in 1980 whatever, but now we're in 1990 whatever and it looks very dated. But then I guess they wanted the brand recognition, so they didn't change it. Interesting challenge.
I think, by the way, the Penguin name went away because Penguin Books went after them, because I think we've covered this before.
I think we talked about that. Yeah, it became Polarware, which is a funny name change, actually. Penguin to Polarware. Yeah. That's sort of clever.
Oh, in fact, actually, one, two shows ago, speaking of us not remembering anything that we said in the past, there was one iteration. I came across an auction of something that I think of as being Polarware or Penguin, but it was sold under Bearware, like Bearware, and it was otherwise the same font. It was very clearly the same company, same game, but it was, so I don't know. I think Polarware worked better, but.
We did talk about that. Yeah, they tried two different rebrandings after they had to stop using Penguin, and Bearware existed for like a month or something. So there's like three software titles that were released under Bearware. Yeah. It's funny.
Okay. Here's the next thing I have. I had no news items, so I have only eBay items, apparently. But this I thought was interesting. I'm not going to necessarily recommend it, but it is a massive Radio Shack Tandy Sharp pocket computer lot with software
titles. That is a lot. Wow, there's some cool stuff in there.
So it has. So it's a lot of these are basically like the small pocket computer things. And there's a tape recorder and there's some software. Most of these things look like sort of long calculators, you know, rectangles, thick rectangles. There's a few printer docks in there. So you take the long rectangles. This is the The TRS-80 PC-2, I think, is the same as the Sharp PC-1500. And they you can put them in these docks where there'll be a little attached printer and maybe some other stuff, some interfaces to the audio. And there's also some games, or some software, but it includes some games, which I thought was maybe almost as interesting as any of the other stuff here. So I really want to know what this game is. I'm trying to get to it, but Invasion Force. There's an Invasion Force game for the PC-2. And how much fun could this be?
Yeah, I wonder. For anyone who doesn't know, these machines have a single line text display, so not a whole lot of opportunity there for gaming.
But there's a lot here. I mean, like, so I see, you know, something like six of the PC-2 PC-1500 type machines, and at least three of these printer docks and a tape recorder.
They have a couple of the later models, which are clamshell, the black ones in the upper left. I always coveted those because they move to the screen to the upper half, so it folds down over the keyboard. And then there was like a middle area, which I think was a membrane keyboard that was like shortcuts for other commands on the normal keyboard. That was like the last model of these that Radio Shack sold, which they were really cool. I had one of these. I had one of the earlier models of this, and I had the dock that allowed you to connect it to a tape recorder for saving and loading programs. And it was a really fun little thing. Like, it was the kind of, like, I would take it on camping trips with the family and stuff, and you could write little basic programs on it and have quite a bit of fun with it, actually. But I had no idea they sold software for them, though. Mm-hmm. Like, there's all kinds of software in this auction lot, and I never knew. There is there's an expansion port on the top of it that plugs into whatever dock you're using. Do these games plug into that, or how do you get the software into the thing?
Well, I think they could either be like little ROM packs or on tape.
On tape, okay. Yeah, on tape.
I think Invasion Force was on tape.
Oh yeah, those look like tapes. Yeah, okay.
Huh. And Curtis mentions, or at least Curtis thinks, that the PC2 had individually controlled pixel graphics, so it might have been possible to have a fun game.
Yeah, the one that I had did not, but it had quite an extensive character set. So, like, I made a lot of card games on it because it had, like, a heart and a club and a diamond and so on. And it had like, a little running man icon that you could do stuff with. So it had a lot of custom characters, but at least the one I had did not have any pixel addressability to it. I don't know exactly which model I had. There was, like, six of them, which are apparently all in this slot.
Problem with an auction like this is it's like a whole collection. Like, it's like instantly you have a collection of PC1 and PC2s. But who's really into these that now doesn't have any, who says, I want to spend $1,000 and kick it off? Most people who are really keen would probably say, like, I've already got half of these. I just want a couple of things or whatever. So it's the difficulty of trying to sell like an entire collection, because what's the market for the auction itself in particular?
Yeah, I think people do this because they want to get rid of everything all at once. Because
PC, it's a pain, like, to ship individually.
So. Yeah, parting all this out would be such a hassle and such a lot of work. But at the same token, like you say, nobody's going to buy this whole lot unless it's dirt cheap.
Right, and that's the aim, is going to be to then split it out and take care, make the money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the price, it'll sit here until the price drops enough to where some eBay flipper is going to be, it's going to be worth their time to buy it and.
And the party out, whatever. Yeah. Kind of thing, maybe instead you get a table at a retro show and set it up and sell it that way and go, great.
Yeah, totally. That's the easy way to get rid of this stuff.
Take your thing or whatever.
Yep.
So,
yeah, and you'll sell 80% of it and the other 20% goes in the bin. Yeah, that's the easy way to get rid of a collection.
Look
at
all that software.
Although the other thing is that there's a lot of duplication here. So if you wanted business statistics, there's whatever, 15 copies.
Yeah. That's a little weird. They must have been buying lots of the software on eBay to get stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of duplicates. So there's really only like five different programs here, and the rest is all duplicates, it looks like.
But I did find Invasion Force was the most sort of interesting seeming thing. You can actually get, if you wanted to download this Invasion Force and see for yourself, there is at PC1500.com, there is a listing. It's in BASIC. So.
Yeah, how about that? Yeah, I don't think you could program these things any other way. I never saw any kind of a way to get to assembly on them. So in the chat, Curtis says that the PC2 specifically did have 7 by 156 pixel addressable graphics. So that would be enough to do something. I had an earlier one that was just text. I don't know if it was the PC1 or the one I had was Tandy branded, or Radio Shack branded. I don't know, these machines had all different brandings. There was Tandy, Radio Shack, and Sharp, and they were all different variations. But the one I had was an earlier one that was simpler, I think, than these.
But it's 7 by 156, if that's pixels, it still is just one line.
Yes.
So it's just like one character line, essentially. So you can only do so much gaming-wise. It's like the world's worst maze.
Yeah,
go
or
right,
like...
Go right!
But if you look at like modern running games, that kind of thing, you could could do a game like that in that amount of space.
Well, I couldn't.
The Google game with the T-Rex where you're running along and jumping over cactuses and stuff. You could do stuff like that, I guess.
But you only jump a little because there's one character.
Exactly.
Bang your head. It's like, oh, man.
It's not a lot of real estate.
So I did kind of want to see what Invasion Force looked like. I did not.
I'm guessing Star Trek type.
Well, so there is an Invasion Force. There's a game called this Invasion Force for the Model 2 and the big TRS-80s. And that is just, it's like Star Trek. It's like,
yeah. Well, the cover of the Invasion Force thing looks Star Trek-y.
Yeah. but I could not find any sort of way to see what it would look like on this. Little one-line display. I came across there's a an ad from Japan for the PC 1500, which, you know, it's just ridiculous. But you can see, you know, it shows the computer going into the printer and printing all kinds of marvelous things. And
what is happening?
It's a magician. Yeah, and it ends with the you know, a magician sort of levitating a woman who was impressed by the graphs or whatever to the point of fainting.
Japan.
But I think the levitation actually had to do with putting this thing into the dock. You know, like you put this into the printer dock, and that I think was what led to the idea of levitating. But anyway, so the PC 1500 available in Japan. But yeah, so I was trying to find a way to actually like see what it looked like, and I found it's actually not a very well emulated platform.
That's surprising.
So I did find one at forever1500.fr. There is a 3D emulator which.
Wow, this is elaborate.
Yeah, so it's the 3D models of the machines. So there's a couple different models of the 1500, and you can sort of physically in a virtual way interact with these things. So, but what I could not figure out how to do is load a tape. So I can click on a tape. I can I can click on the printer dock and install the thing into it.
Wow. Someone put a lot of effort into this.
I'm going to faint. Please levitate.
Yeah.
This is great.
And you can, you know, you can zoom in and type on these things. But the thing is that, like, I still don't know how to make it load a tape. I see a tape there.
I would assume you connect the tape recorder first.
Yeah.
And then put the tape.
Perhaps. I mean, I think these things had tapes built in, so you may not need to, in the emulator, do a connection. But at the moment, there's a list of tapes that they have. I still don't know how to make them load, but I don't know how to add a new one to that. It's still a very cool site.
Maybe you can't, yeah. Yeah, the one I had, the dock gave you three connections. Line out, microphone, and remote control. And then you had to connect that with RCA cables to a tape recorder that supported the remote control line, which most tape recorders did not. That was the problem I had with this thing, is I had the dock, and I could never find a tape recorder that supported the remote control line. That was not a common thing. So you didn't have to like manually press play and then type to load a program. It would start and stop the tape deck automatically when you loaded and saved programs with this remote control line. But that was apparently not a well-supported standard on tape decks.
So this emulator, you can't type. You have to use the mouse to click on each key.
It's gosh.
As if Chiclet keyboards are not hell enough. They're like, my friend, you think you didn't like it before. Now you're going to use a joystick to aim a cursor.
Right. Actually, no, it's not bad. There are certain things that don't seem to work very well with typing. So I can't type a question mark, but I can type like C load. Which is the C load question mark is supposed to be the way that you load a cassette. But yeah, so if you can't get the keyboard to respond.
Is C load question mark? Like, oh, please, will you please?
You have to be polite.
That's an odd choice.
But I thought it's a nice emulator. The other emulator, the one that does seem like most likely to work, although still I can't make it load a tape, is POC Emule, which actually emulates a whole lot of stuff. So it does do the 1500, the PC 1500, which is what I was after. But there's a web version of this. And you can pick from among quite a number of models. So if you wanted to pick some sort of HP calculator, RadioShack TI calculator, Sharp calculator, or specifically popular ones like the 1500, or the PC2, you can click it, and like the other one, I think you can either use your mouse to click on it, or you can type. Generally, I have picked one that I don't know how to use. Oh, here we go. Anyway, but yeah, so it's pretty cool, but again, I don't know how to make it work.
But I guess if it's the emulator, and you did find the listing for the entire basic source, you could just type it in.
Yeah. In principle. I've managed to zoom out so far.
By aiming a cursor at little chiclet keys in a virtual environment.
Yeah. You have to drag each character over.
That would be excellent. Yeah.
That would be the worst possible way to type in a basic program. As though typing in basic programs wasn't terrible enough. Now we're going to make you do it that way.
But anyway, I just on the basis of this auction, I discovered at least a little bit about what's out there in terms of this emulation of these things. So
I'm surprised these aren't better emulated. Like, there's no MAME option for these.
Doesn't work yet. MAME does have, and of course, MAME does is gives you this little display and nothing else. So, like, it's very ugly to look at. These are fun because you have actual, like, in this pocket POC EMU one, you can actually like pick up the calculator and drop it in there and it'll attach.
Yeah, these are fun. Like, people have spent a lot of effort trying to recreate the experience of using these things, which was a lot of fiddling with all these different physical pieces, but not a lot of effort into the usability of actually getting software to run on the emulator.
This one is it's got some cloud options and some extra stuff that if you subscribe to it, so they're the creator is trying to make this viable enough to keep working on it, and so there are some things that you can subscribe for, but I think loading is not one of them. I think my belief is it actually doesn't exist in this yet, but I've only just entered this ecosystem, so I don't really know. Anyway, that was the Massive Radio Shack pocket computer auction, but it led me into a bit of a rabbit hole of a sort. This is, I don't know about Simon's BASIC, but it just made me think that this must be a BASIC where every line is like, 10 Simon Says print.
Go to 10. Simon didn't say go to 10. Yeah.
Has anyone ever heard of Simon's BASIC? Probably I haven't.
Never.
It has a foreword by David Simon, so that is probably the author of Simon's BASIC.
Or a weird coincidence.
Yeah, I can certainly see there being a market for
a better BASIC.
Other BASICs on the Commodore, because the C64 BASIC was sort of notoriously bad.
I thought that was the same one. It's AppleSoft, right? Almost. I mean, like, it's another Microsoft BASIC.
It's a Microsoft BASIC, but it's a very, very early snapshot of it that then Tramiel refused to ever update because he managed to get it unlicensed. He managed to get it for a one-time cost, which nobody else did. He managed to, like, pull one over on Bill Gates before Gates had figured out that licensing is a better way to get rich than selling stuff piecemeal. And so because of that, though, he was kind of locked into that, and he refused to ever give Bill Gates any more money. So it was this, like, bad early snapshot of a Microsoft BASIC that was never, ever updated in decades after that.
So perhaps Simon's BASIC is a good one. It might well be. I only just saw the joke, as usual.
Bunny Hero in the comments says that Simon's BASIC added a lot of graphics commands to Commodore BASIC. That was the main thing with Commodore BASIC, because it had no way to do all the fancy Commodore stuff like graphics and sound, which seems like a massive oversight. So this apparently added that.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I did a little bit of, like, a tiny, tiny little bit of programming on a friend's Commodore 64, and it was all pokes, like, you would poke things in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Any Commodore program was all peaks and pokes, because all the good stuff was hidden away in ROM access points and stuff.
Okay, in the show notes I have called this "Turn Anything into a 6160AV." it is it's an unusual auction,
which was a great computer, so that appeals to me.
It's basically a bunch of the badges that went on the front of the cases of these Macs, and they all had the same case, more or less, so this was the number that indicated this was the 6100 rather than the 7100 or the 8100 or the 7500 or the 8500 or the 8600, and then what is the next thing? I think the next thing might be the processor speed or something, the 60?
Yeah, the 60 is the megahertz, and the AV is because it was the AV version. These probably existed because I bet you there's a way to upgrade, like a 660 with a PowerPC board, and probably then you get this.
Probably, yeah. There was a lot of obscure upgrade paths within the 90s Mac infrastructure. Yeah.
I've talked about it in previous episodes. I had had a Quadra 800, a brilliant, beautiful, wonderful computer that I then destroyed by upgrading to an 8100 slow as molasses PC. Cost me like $1,000 to lobotomize my beautiful computer. What a foolish move.
Fortunately, the last foolish move.
And you could upgrade like the 2CX to the 2CI, and you could upgrade like the 2 to the 2FX, and like there was a lot of weird internal upgrading you could do on those machines.
Yeah, and this is again, I think we mentioned this before, but this is remnants from Sun remarketing. So I mean, this was a large Apple dealer dealing in obsolete computers.
So if you bought a 6160 from Sun remarketing, you should open up and see what's actually in there. It's like, hold on, this is a 2SI. Yeah. Oh, you got me again, Sun remarketing.
It's interesting to see, you know, what's on eBay from them. So this one is a Mac OS 8.5 in-store demo version. So I mean, it's 8.5 probably is not that exciting or rare, but what's interesting about this, I guess, is that it was the version that was sent to dealers to put on their demo machines, so not for general consumption, and it had demo software on it, you know. So I never really thought about that, but you know, when you go into a modern Apple store, they're running something, you know, they're not just letting you play around on the desktop.
That's a good point. Yeah, it looks like it's the desktop, but it's got, obviously must be limited in some way, like you can't open browsers and just start doing stuff.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is archived or what, but it seems interesting. $35 is what is being asked for it. I haven't been saying what the prices are for things, but if you wanted to turn anything into a 6160 AV, like, for example, a Mac OS 8.5 in-store demo, that would be $40. what else? Oh, yeah. Also, there are some Apple Newton external fax modems available, which I always find this just like comically obsolete from 7 different directions.
I didn't know this existed, actually. I had an Apple Newton modem, but it wasn't this, so that's interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think I have one of these, but of course, I mean, what are you going to do with it? That's the whole amusing thing. 2400 baud.
Yeah, even at the time, it wasn't very useful. So yeah, I had a PCMCIA modem for my Newton because the Newton had a PCMCIA slot. It was the coolest modem ever. It had a tiny, tiny little phone jack that you pushed that was the thickness of the PCMCIA card, and it slid out from the card, and then the phone jack,
cool.
And then you plugged in the phone jack like vertically. It was very clever.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, very fragile looking, and I love that thing, and I don't think I ever used it because there was just nowhere. By the time the Newton was out, even there was nowhere you could go that you could just plug into a phone line and dial up some whatever BBS or whatever to try and telnet on your Newton.
Yeah.
Like it was just a useless thing at the end of the day. But I love the idea of it.
Yeah,
coolest modem I ever had was by Newer Tech. It was one of those probably 300 baud or 1200 baud modem where it was two acoustic coupler things that you Velcro strapped to a phone, and so it was like this little mini modem thing you could break out and use on a payphone or whatever, and it would just accommodate any kind of phone, and you would strap them on to the handset and use it. It was super cool for the traveling hacker.
Yeah, right. Or for exactly, Red Boxer or whatever.
Exactly.
So if you wanted a brand new Newton 2400 baud external fax modem, $23. So, not bad. I think that was basically it. Well, yeah, here's one more. It's sort of similar, just like old stock. It's kind of interesting in a way. It is replacement mouse cables for the kind of mouse that plugged into a Mac Plus and a 128K Mac. You know, the early ones that had, I guess, 9-pin, some number of pins like 9 connector.
I can see somebody needing one and like, no. I want $40 and you got to buy 5. It's like, man.
Yeah.
It's an aggressive eBay auction.
Yeah.
This is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I, this is, again, someone who's got a lot of inventory trying to get rid of it, I think. But
yeah. Yeah, I can't imagine the buyer for any of these auctions, honestly. Yeah. Like, who's going to want any of this?
Paul.
Stuff? Yeah.
Paul is always the buyer. The answer is always.
I think I do have a number of mouseless Macs of this era, maybe not quite. I don't know. They went pretty quickly to ADB.
So, do you have 5?
I don't know if I have that many that need mice. But it is, it's not, it was, at least it wasn't that hard to come across a, you know, 9-inch Mac, or, you know, 9-inch screen Mac without without all of its stuff. You know, it's just the thing. And because these are kind of like special mice, or like special connectors, it's, I'm sure I have a few that are sort of non-functional completely.
But you would have to specifically have the right kind of mouse that had a bad cable on it to use these. Like,
yeah, that's... this isn't the mouse. This is just the cable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think what one would hope for is that someone would get all this stuff and then start repairing old Macs for people, basically. But,
so this person has 8 lots of this available.
Yeah.
8 lots of 5 mouse.
That sounds great.
Boy, they're swimming in these cables.
And that's why they don't want to sell them one at a time. Because there aren't that many people who want. I think Ryan Cook here is hoping that there are at least 8 people who want such a cable, but not that there are whatever 40.
Yeah, like if you really need one, you're probably willing to spend $40 to end up with 5 of them. Because if he was selling them individually, he'd have to sell them for $10, and he'd get $10 and still have 4 of them to get rid of. This way, he's getting rid of all of them.
With the cables rare enough and more than $40?
No, it's just you'd have to, if you specifically had a mouse with a bad cable, like that would be the only use case for this.
I mean, isn't it just cheaper to get another mouse?
Because I think this is the MO100,
yeah, maybe.
Right, that has these, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is the MO100, yeah. Or, although, as Charles Megan famously taught us all, there's MO100 is like 20 different mice, so who knows?
I was just thinking exactly that. I'm like, I remember Charles saying, okay.
Yeah, every time I see that now, I'm like, oh, okay, so this tells me nothing about what this mouse actually is. It might be a Mac mouse, it might be an early 2C mouse, it might be, who knows what this thing is.
Yeah. Ryan Cook is the offspring of the Cook, whose first name I am blanking on, who ran Sun Remarketing. And so, you know, was there when all the leases went under the bulldozers and that sort of thing. It's interesting to keep an eye on what comes up there because it is largely like old retail stuff. Yeah, and I guess also interesting because it's someone who was kind of working commercially in the area that some of us are, you know, kind of finding ourselves in now with like needing to repair old machines of the Apple variety that, you know, Apple's no longer going to be of any assistance with. Anyway, I'll leave mine at that. That was good enough. I guess we're already to close the discussions. So, Carrington, do you have any closing thoughts to add?
I got nothing.
All right.
Been doing no retro things, alas. Got rid of my couch.
Ah, yes. Look at that.
Burdensome furniture.
You have enough room for one person to sit next to the
more
record
echoes.
Player.
Get rid of all the soft things.
Excellent. And I actually, this closing, at least for both Carrington and me, these closing notes will be pretty short because I don't feel like I've done a lot. I think I've said in the last couple times that we recorded that I've had to consolidate 2 rooms of this collection into one, and it's actually going not too badly. I mean, I got some wire shelves, and actually, so I got a wire shelf. I thought, well, okay, you know, what I really need is shelves so that I don't have like huge stacks of things, but you know, at least occasionally there's some support, you know, so that there aren't big towers that would fall over. And then I thought, well, ideally what I would get is shelves that have wheels on the bottom, so I can kind of like stack them up together, but I can pull them out to get at what's behind them or whatever. So I got a few of those, and I stacked some things up. And you know, somewhere it does say like, you know, this is what they're rated for weight wise if they're, you know, if they have wheels or if they're on the ground or if they are in motion. And
or downhill.
So I, you know, piled a bunch of stuff on these, and then I started. And I was going to move one of them, and you can kind of tell kind of where this was going to go, but so like one of them sort of broke its ankle, you might say. It was it kind of like suddenly it was tipping toward me full of very heavy things. Like,
and that's how Paul died.
Whatever happened to Paul? Funny story.
Yeah. So,
well, I found it funny.
He died the way he lived. piles of retro crap.
Retro crap.
But yeah, it was a tense couple moments there. I was like, all right, well, this is heavy. I can't move to do anything about it.
I should have collected handhelds was the last thing I said.
Protect the Sam Coupe with your body.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, essentially it was the things that held the wheels. The wheels are, they're not directly under the bars. The there was basically too much pressure on the wheel, and so it bent. And once bent, you know, that was it. So I took the wheel out. While holding the thing, I kind of extracted the dead wheel and slid a disc 2 underneath the... which is about the right height.
They are sturdy. Yeah, they are sturdy. It's a steel box, yeah. So sure.
It took me a little while to figure out, like, what did I have handy that would work? But I was pretty pleased with that choice. So yeah, that was good enough.
It'd be that or an Image Raider 2.
Yeah, right. So anyway, that was enough. That made it stable enough that I could unload it and take the rest of the wheels off. And you know, so it now is not a rolling shelf. And all the rolling ones have very light stuff on them. I learned a little bit in that process, but I think it's going to look okay. I mean, it's not going to look like a huge storage space with stuff piled into it. It's going to be like somewhat organized on shelves. And I still am hoping to kind of go through it and take photos and videos and move things out of that office eventually. But anyway, that's my project. So what I wrote in the notes was office reorg continues still fatality free.
Yeah. But close.
All right, Quinn, any closing thoughts?
I guess the theme is moving retro stuff because I also did a bunch of moving. So my office behind me here is more retro looking than usual because I've got my 2GS sitting right there. And actually, I bet I can turn my camera and reveal the... my Apple II Plus sitting right there.
Ooh.
And my Commodore 64 sitting down there. And the reason for all of that is that I had to move everything upstairs. So I had all my retro stuff on tables and stuff downstairs. And we're redoing the floors down there. So that means redoing floors sucks because it means everything has to go. You cannot leave absolutely anything
crazy
down
Quinn's
there.
Crazy warehouse.
So,
everything must go.
Yeah, so we had all the stuff that was in the basement now has to find a place to live upstairs for some number of weeks. So my retro stuff is all heaped around me in here. I feel a little bit like Paul. I'm living in a sphere of retro objects just out of frame. And all the other stuff. The killer is the pinball machine that is down there. It weighs 600 pounds. It is not coming back up the stairs. That thing is never coming back up the stairs. It took 6 movers to get it down those stairs. 6 of the biggest guys I've ever seen to get it down those stairs. So it can live. It's fortunately there's room for it in the furnace room. So it's getting slid into the furnace room when the flooring company gets here, and that's where it will live for the duration. But so all the retro stuff had to come upstairs. But the good news is that when the flooring is done, I'll have a more space down there. So I'm going to have a retro computer area that I'll be setting up. So I'll have everything kind of displayed, which is partly why I'm interested in right. Dust covers. Because it'll be nice to have everything sitting out. But I know I'm not going to use it as much as I imagine that I will. I will say it's easier to use stuff once it's out. Like my retro stuff's always been stored in closets and bins and parents' basements. And then you definitely never use it because it's too difficult. It's like I have my 2C Plus in my office closet here because it's my most favorite thing. So I keep it handy, but I honestly don't use it that much because it's such a hassle. Even just being in a bin in the closet, it's too much work to get it out and set it up and find the power supply and plug it in and yada, yada, yada. But I feel like if the stuff is set up to where I can literally just walk over and turn it on and stick in a disc, I might actually use it
definitely.
And have some fun with it.
I've got my iMac G4 set up. Like it is... co-computing with my regular computer.
Yeah.
And so I use it all the time. I'll sit down and play a game, whatever, only because it's so convenient to sit down, turn it on, and I'm working.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because I have found that with other things, like my main machine, you know, I keep it handy because I can literally just walk over and flip it on and play a quick game of Golden Axe or whatever. And so I do that occasionally, and it's fun because it's right there and I can do it. Lowering the barrier to entry, I guess, or lowering the hassle level for using this stuff is kind of the goal. And I just like to look at it, so it'll be fun to have it set up. I'll have kind of a retro room with the pinball machine and the
cool.
retro computers and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's coming.
That does sound like the ideal goal.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. It's going to be kind of a lounge space down there with all of this cool old retro stuff kind of in one room. I got a bunch of, I have decorations for the walls. I've got, an 8-inch floppy disk, and I got some core memory and, some, antique kind of and vintage tech stuff that I can hang on the walls. And,
nice.
So it should be fun.
Excellent. Well, you'll have to, I'm sure you will show many photos of this when it's operational.
Yeah, someday, yeah, it's going to be a very long, slow kind of thing that I'll be working on. But yeah, eventually it'll be a cool space down there.
All right. Excellent. Well, that was behind the scenes, it was a little bit tricky to get this going because I basically just drove in from Canada, parked my car, and got on the camera here. But so at the sort of beginning of the day, we were all in Canada. I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Funny. It's an all-Canadian show.
But anyway. All right. Well, thanks, though. Thank you, people in YouTube, for somehow managing to be here, even though I gave you 10 minutes warning at best. But
a surprising number of people always find us, no matter when and how or when we record. It's amazing. Random days and times, we still get streamer watchers. So thank you all.
All right, so that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more via Gopher at rcrpodcast.com also. You can discuss the shows in the forum at forum.vcfed.org somewhere. You can follow RCR on Mastodon and get toots about the shows 10 minutes before we start. that's at podcasts.social at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast, where we think Michael is taking care of it. I don't know. Sometime we should decide. but thank you for being there, those who are there. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute! Hey? Because it's Canadian.
It's a place of love and color, where pretty girls can fall from the sky, where a horse can change from red to blue in a moment it passes you.